This sounds like, good Lord, this is about to blow up.
What you mean, Carson, is you're getting shot at.
It's a fight to the death at this point, and it's not like you can call timeout.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Hello and welcome to Best Case, Worst Case. This is your host, Jim Clemente, former New York City prosecutor, retired FBI profiler, and writer-producer on CBS's Criminal Minds. With me today is my co-host.
Hi, everybody. It's Francie Hakes, former state and federal prosecutor. Hi, Jim.
How you doing, Francie? Well, I know you're as excited as I am, Francie, because we have back with us today a longtime friend and colleague and an amazing DEA agent.
My name's Carson Ulrich. I retired from the DEA 2 years ago, and I had about 25 years of service. It's a pleasure to be here, Jim.
Great having you, Carson. Thanks for coming back. We'd like to continue you telling the story about a case that was part of Project Snowcap, and you were, when we left, in the jungles of Bolivia. So set the setting again. What's your mission, who are you with, and where are you right now?
Well, when we left off, we had inserted by aircraft and come down the river by Zodiac, located the objective, which is a ranch that had an airstrip, secured that in the morning, and had encountered one of the villagers and convinced him it was in his interest to maybe show us where these Colombians were. And reluctantly, he agreed to do so.
And just as a reminder for our listeners, the Colombians you're looking for were known as sicario or assassins that were extremely dangerous, right?
Yes, they were members of the Cali cartel at that time, which is probably the world's most premier drug trafficking organization, from Cali to Colombia.
So there you are in the jungle with this villager, and you have how many people with you that are going to break off from the ranch and go and find these assassins?
We decide to take myself, the other DEA agent, and two Coast Guard. MLED is the International Maritime Law Enforcement. It's like a tactical team within the Coast Guard. And two of the Bolivians, and we left the other eight Bolivians back at the ranch to continue to interrogate the occupants of the ranch.
And so where are you going to go with your smaller team?
Well, unfortunately, the villager told us that the Colombians were upriver, meaning we could not sneak up on them by paddling. We'd have to go under motorized movement up the river, which has a sound signature. Fortunately for us, the misery of the rain that we had endured was our best form of cover. It muffled the sounds, and it made for a very wet and damp, cold environment.
Sounds miserable. Sounds totally miserable.
It was very miserable. I mean, hypothermia is a very painful experience, and we were very close to hypothermia.
You just would never expect that in the jungles of South America. You think to yourself that that is a tropical, humid environment. It's hard to understand how you could be, you know, cold.
Yeah, it's just when you're laying on the ground, when you're laying in water, it just sucks all the heat from your body.
So it's cold and damp, but the rain is your friend because it's muffling the sound of your motor on the boat. Where do you go and what happens?
Well, the villager stated that there was a trailhead that came right to the river's edge, and that very often they had a sentry or a guard there, and that if we went up the river, that he would be there and would see us. So we were concerned, and we decided to insert early and go on foot and parallel the river to try to find this encampment. And in doing so, every step that we took, the villager became more vocal, more animated, more nervous. And he's creating this narrative of, look, these guys are killers. They're going to kill us all. And it isn't lost on any of us. There's only four Americans and two Bolivians going after a group of at least seven or eight or more. and we're going into an environment that they control and that we knew they were heavily armed, and we didn't necessarily have the advantage, especially if they spotted us or heard us before we arrived. And the more that this guy would talk, the more his reluctance was articulated and kind of resonated with us. The team began to like second guess it. Like, we don't have enough guys. We've kind of tried this. Let's go ahead and turn back. We came to a point where we stopped, and we had like an internal team debate where all three of the Americans, except myself, wanted to stop and turn back. And I told them, look, this is why I joined the DEA. This is why I went through all this training. There's Colombians out here. I think we should continue this mission. And if you're not comfortable, let me go up by myself and I'll scout and I'll come back and I'll tell you what I see. So we had this team debate, and it was decided that they would let me go up by myself to scout. And as we were concluding the debate, the villager had snuck away. He used the opportunity to escape. And then that really even kind of affected the team's morale even more. Like, okay, now we're by ourselves. We don't have a scout. We're going to turn around. We're out of here. And it became like a very aggressively whispered argument where I'm like, you know, shut up. We're almost here. We're going to find him. And while we're arguing, I kind of look around a tree, and we are right outside their camp, like 30, at the most 40 yards away the whole time.
Wow.
And I just basically like put my fist up and say, guys, they're right there. Fortunately for us, the rain had kept them warm and cozy inside their buildings, and they had these opaque tarps that were covering the windows and such. So we could see them moving around and hear them, and we did not believe that they were aware of our presence at this moment.
Well, and Carson, that brings up a great point. You didn't think they were aware of your presence, but you have a missing villager who knows where he went or what he did. You also have, if my math skills are good, 8 Bolivians that you don't know if you can trust back at the ranch with the co-conspirators talking to who knows whom or telling people who knows what. So you're still in a very dangerous situation.
Yeah. And we have ignorant faith that what we're doing is right. We're just basically going on the belief that we believe in what we're doing and we're going to continue the mission and follow it through.
Okay, so you discover that this group of men who you believe to be Colombians and probably heavily armed is literally a few yards away from you behind this tree.
Yes, so we approach them as quietly as possible and we set up an L. An L shape is designed to allow us to react, and each of us are able to fire without the worry of crossfire. It gives us a tactical advantage. So we had the advantage of positioning. We also had the advantage of terrain in that there were very large trees that we could use as cover around this building. And they were in a disadvantage of they were all consolidated in this building. And as I move to my tree and I lay prone in this mud puddle, one of the Bolivians is tromping through the water and then he belly flops next to me and then makes a splashing sound. And as I look over him like, are you serious? The Colombians all begin to hush each other and argue and say, shut up. I heard him saying, cállate la boca, which means shut your mouth. And they're like, listen outside. And they notice someone outside and they're talking. And now we are both somewhat aware of each other's presence.
So what happens next? I mean, this sounds like, good Lord, this is about to blow up.
Yeah, it is, literally. So the Bolivian commander identifies himself as a police officer and he says he orders everyone to come out. And before he can finish any more of his sentence, we receive automatic weapons fire from inside the building because we could hear them grabbing and charging weapons.
So this is a great lesson for our listeners on Behind Police Lines. You just heard Carson say, and so we began to receive automatic weapons fire. He speaks so matter-of-factly like he's writing a report, which was great. Part of my training as a prosecutor was reading reports from people like Carson and Jim. What you mean, Carson, is you're getting shot at.
Yes. On the one hand, that's very true and it's somewhat upsetting, but you also realize that they're in a bad way. The fire is random. It is sporadic. It's not effective. It's not hitting us. And I'm just rolling behind this tree, letting them do what they are going to do. And I have a grenade launcher. And so I believe I'm going to end this thing relatively quick. I put 2 40 mic grenade rounds right inside their building. I see the holes go right inside the tarp.
Wow. And what happened?
Neither one of them detonated. To kind of make fun of myself, we were too close. There's a minimum arming distance for the 40 millimeter grenade round. It has to endure so many revolutions in the air as a safety mechanism before the round will arm, so that it will preclude you from injuring yourself by being within the range, and it's 30 yards away. So we were within a 30-yard range, probably 20, 25 yards away, and the rounds didn't detonate. So I went to my rifle, and we began to slightly advance, and I put one more grenade round in the far side of the building, which is the area of the L that we cannot see or react to. If they are squirting or leaving the building, they'll be killed. The round does detonate, and it puts fragmentation. It has a 5-meter kill radius, a 15-meter wound radius, so it's an area effect weapon, and it sends fragmentation into the building, as well as announce our presence. So it's the concussion of the explosion allows us to advance on them as we fire and engage them into the windows of the building.
Well, and doesn't a weapon like that too, Carson, that it's also got to have a very disorienting effect on the people closest to the blast?
Yeah, people think of grenades from like watching a movie or something, but the concussion is quite overwhelming. It's very destructive.
Well, it sounds like this is a real battle. This is like a war zone here. And what's going on with you? What's going on in your head? Well, how are you feeling about all this?
Well, you want to survive. You want to prevail. And so you're advancing and you're moving towards a very dangerous situation where, you know, there are people with guns, but it's a fight to the death at this point. And it's not like you can call time out or say, hey, we were just kidding. We want to go home now. You advance by firing. You move up to the building. You fire into the building. And then as soon as we are able to like put eyes on, we can see all of them are wounded and they're looking in the barrels of our guns and we're pointing them into the windows of the structure that they're hiding in.
So do they surrender?
There's seven of them. And so they're doing different things. Some of them are shrieking and screaming. They all believe they're going to die. All of them are wounded. And we now have the advantage of we are now outside the building. We can shoot and engage them at our leisure. If they return fire, they're going to all be killed. And so it's when the fight goes from a fight to now trying to take control of the situation and do no more violence. And honestly, we want to treat them. We tell them, don't move your hands. If you move your hands, we're going to kill you. Because if once we move inside the building and we're in close quarters proximity of seven armed men, if one of them grabs for the gun, all hell's going to break loose.
Right.
And there's no way to segregate necessarily who is firing, who is not, because they're all going to be moving around at that point. None of them are going to probably stay still. And we don't want that to happen.
Well, wait, before you tell us what happens, Carson, I'm afraid I have to pull my prosecutor cross-examination card and say that when Jim asked you what you were feeling when you went into the building, you didn't really answer. You said you wanted to survive, but we promise our listeners behind police lines and telling them how brave agents like you risk your lives and how it impacts you. So for those of us who have never and hopefully will never be in a firefight, what's actually going through your mind? Is it a rush of adrenaline? Do you see things clearly? Do you feel any fear? Tell us what's going on.
Your heart rate obviously is increasing. It's beating out of your chest. So breathing becomes more difficult. Fine motor skill is not as easy to accomplish. It's more of a gross motor skill thing. And you are reacting to what is happening on your left and right side. If you see one of your teammates advancing and bounding towards them, you're waiting and you are automatically going to do the same. It's not like you can just sit this one out, but you're afraid. The number one, you know, emotion you're feeling is fear. I mean, because you know either you or the person you're facing is going to die. You are within 5 yards and advancing on someone shooting at you and you don't see them yet. They're firing from the building. The grenade round goes off and we use that to advance. We fire as we advance. You know that lifting that tarp, you could get a bullet right in the face. And so you throw the tarp up and you angle away and we do what we call digging the corner. And you're just trying to look in the building and you're now using your commands. We all have stopped firing, but at any moment we could start firing again. And we're trying to convince them this is over. You're basically not only outnumbered, but none of us are hurt. You're all hurt. And we're pointing guns at you at about a 3-meter distance. So the number one feeling is fear. You know, this is the first time I've ever stood over someone I shot. And you don't have this like anger. There's no animosity. You actually want this to be done. But you know it could at any moment spark up again. But you're like almost praying, like, stop. You're like saying with your heart, dude, don't make me kill you. Don't make me kill you. We'll be right back.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Byte Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Whether you're working out, walking, or running errands, Audible can help you keep your heart rate up month after month with their pulse-pounding collection of thrilling audiobooks that you can't hear anywhere else. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, which includes thousands of titles. This month, check out the Audible original, The Space Within. It's a chilling 8-part story about a psychiatrist, Dr. Maddie Weil, voiced by Academy Award winner Jessica Chastain, who is tasked with unlocking the memories of a child who went missing for 7 hours. Maddie soon discovers that there are more who have faced similar experiences, and the truth of what is happening to them may impact the fate of humankind. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500. That's audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500.
Wow. It just sounds like chaotic and then incredibly intense. And I can't wait to hear what happened next with these. I presume that you have now discovered here they are, the Colombians, the Sicario, the assassins. We have them.
Yes. And they're all armed with military weapons, automatic weapons. And we enter the building in a very aggressive manner, taking their guns and flex tying them all. And as soon as we secure them, we have what we call a priority of work. We want to establish a security perimeter. We don't know that we have them all. And so that we could effectively treat these people that we've taken into custody.
So let me get this straight. These people moments ago are shooting at you, trying to kill you. And your protocol is to maintain control and safety and then treat them, try to save their lives, right?
Yeah, that in fact, our number one priority, aside from surviving and continuing our security, is to keep these people alive. We only have a limited amount of medical equipment, and we're using it all to save these people.
And that's very different than what they would do if they had you in custody, right?
No, they would dance and taunt as they shot us in the face, one at a time.
That's what separates American law enforcement from so many others is the professionalism. And that's what you described earlier. This isn't personal, not for you. Maybe it is for them. So what happens next?
Well, most of them have superficial wounds in the appendages, legs, arms, abdomen. One of them took around into the lung and as what we recognize as tension pneumothorax, where the lung begins to fill with air as well as fluids, and it compresses the lung and the capacity to breathe, and he loses consciousness. I remember actually taking him and throwing him out the window as we threw them all out the window. So once they're hogtied, we lift them physically and toss them out of the building. So where they're guarded, because there's inside the building, there's all these weapons, all this ammunition, an area that we cannot clear completely. We don't want them to reach for something. And there's 800 kilograms of cocaine.
Wait, Carson, 800 kilos of cocaine?
Yeah, just short of. I think it was like 780 total.
And can you give our listeners some idea of what that looks like in physical size?
If you like went to Home Depot and saw pallets of mulch, it would be like 2 pallets of mulch probably.
So basically 4 feet by 4 feet by 4 feet high?
Yes.
Oh my God. Wow. All right. That's a lot of cocaine. How much is that worth street value?
Multi-millions. A kilogram of cocaine is at that time for about $30,000 wholesale. But once you break it down and it's sold to individual users, it's stepped on many times, the kilogram that could be sold for as much as 90,000. So just say 90,000 times 800.
Wow.
Well, I'm doing the math real quick and that's $72 million.
It's a lot. It's more than my salary.
Yeah, that's a lot. No wonder they're shooting at you. But you said you toss them out the window, and that seems to me a little rough. What do you mean? You tossed them out the window. Were you handing them to somebody, or you were just throwing them?
No, like sacks of potatoes. Look, you're just tying them with zip ties. Their weapons are all around. You are intermixed. They can touch you. They can grab you. They can go for a gun. We are tying them, doing what we call a high-risk search. We roll over and make sure there's nothing in their waist, physically lifting them and throwing them out the window. And they are impacting the ground. They're lucky. That's all we did to them. But once we have them outside, we set up like a medical triage. And we have IVs in them and we treat them. And, you know, they're not, you know, listen, they only fell like 2 feet, 3 feet in the air, you know.
Okay. Well, that's what I was trying to show. You said out of a window, but it's just a tent, really.
Yeah, it's the window ledge is like 3 feet off the ground. We're just tossing them out that on the ground. But we have to get them out of the building where all their weapons and all of their belongings are. And we have to do it in a safe manner because, look, if one of them reaches for a gun, they would much rather us toss them out of a window than have to react to one of them. Because when you have 7, 8 killers, it's not hard to believe that one of them is going to be like deadly stupid. Still think, oh, I can go ahead and prevail here and get to a gun and shoot these guys.
Right.
Well, and Carson, so I'm feeling nervous for you at this point because I'm thinking about all the unknown factors and you're still in the jungle and now you've had what I imagine is a very large firefight. You have to be at least a little bit worried about them having backup somewhere or someone bad coming and being overly curious and you being vulnerable again. So what'd you do?
Well, the untrained or the natural tendency is to focus your attention inward, because all the activity is happening inside this perimeter. But the discipline is we have to have security up. So we put at least 3 to 4 people, whenever possible, in a security posture. We didn't have that many people. So we had 2 that we told, you know, eyes out, don't let anyone come near us, security. And once we secure these prisoners, we begin to treat them and we decide we want to go get our vessel. So we send one of the Coast Guardsmen and one of the Bolivians into the jungle to get our boat and bring it up to the river to the trailhead so that we can get the boat as close as possible. So that if we have to transport these injured, we can do it without having to carry them a long distance.
Carson, this is insane. I mean, you're in the middle of a firefight, in the middle of a jungle. You have 800 kilograms of cocaine there. What are you going to do with all that? I mean, you can't carry it out on your backs.
No, what we typically do is we take representative samples from each of the bags, like 3 samples, photograph it, and then we burn it with diesel, burn it in place. But that's low on our priority of work. We have to get our vessel back. The other thing I didn't mention is that we were supposed to have radio checks every 2 hours on the hour, and we were never able to make comms. And so we are like 18 hours behind our first communication obligation, and we have not made communication with our base. And we know that's going to have them upset.
So you couldn't communicate. You couldn't call in backup reinforcement or get somebody to air lift you out of there. What do you end up doing?
Well, I go to the bad guys' radio. These guys talk to Bogota and to Cali. They have these radio antennas all set up, and I just dial in our frequency, and I get on the phone, and my call sign was Gator 8. I'm like, Gator 1, Gator 1, this is Gator 8. And immediately, they're like, dude, where have you been, man? What's going on? Tell us. And I'm trying to explain to them the situation. You know, we have 800 kilos of cocaine. We just got finished with a firefight. We have 7 wounded, all bad guys, no casualties on our part.
Okay. And then what do you do next? How do you get out of there?
Well, while I'm talking, there's gunfire in the background. And they're like, what is that? What does that sound? And I'm like, it's gunfire. Well, who's shooting? I go, I don't know. It's unidentified. We'll figure it out. And they kind of panic and they go, look, burn the drugs and get out of there. And I'm like, well, these people are really wounded. One of them's probably not going to survive. And they're not aware of the whole situation. And we're all aware of our obligation here. No one's going to leave these people. It doesn't matter who they are. And so I said, let us take care of this gunfire and we'll get back to you. So I'm kind of tracking the gunfire with my M79 and I'm thinking maybe I'll put a round over there. And it's a good thing I didn't, because one of the Coast Guard guys, hey, that's Petty Officer, maybe so-and-so, shooting a distress signal. So he's firing 3 rounds. I said, give me my rifle. I fire 3 rounds. And it was him. And then he was able to link back up with us. It took about 24 hours to get helicopters in. And we treated them all, seized the drugs, and all 7 of them survived.
Wow. Well, that's amazing, because that guy was seriously injured and you were able to save his life.
Yeah, we were. We didn't have the capability of doing a needle decompression. We were simply able to treat him for shock, use an IV. And fortunately, we got a real medic, an 18 Delta there, who saved him in enough time, and he didn't expire overnight.
So Carson, what happened to the drugs and the assassins? Did these things make their way to the United States? Did they form a prosecution in this, or was the whole point of it just to take them off the board?
Well, we're always looking for U.S. venue. We're always looking at larger cases. This was an overt act in a much larger case out of the Bogota office. But with respect to these individual defendants, they were prosecuted according to Bolivian laws. They were not prosecuted in the United States. There wasn't, you know, any attempt to find a U.S. venue or jurisdiction. And the drugs themselves were, samples were taken and they were burned. It was all photographed and videoed. It was 800 kilos, but we're not going to bring 800 kilos back with us. We brought back like three.
And rumor has it, Carson, that there was some sort of award or decoration that resulted from this very dangerous operation. Can you tell us about that?
This was my first mission. I received the DEA Award for Valor, and it was the first of two such awards I received in my career.
I believe, I mean, he's not going to say this, Francie, but I believe Carson is the only DEA agent or anybody in the DOJ to receive that Medal of Valor twice in their career. So you are an American hero, Carson, and we're so glad that you're here, that you've survived, and that you were the guy who decided that right from the start, you're going to take on the most dangerous missions because those kinds of missions have the greatest results.
No, thank you for saying it. I appreciate it. I'm humbled by it.
And can you tell us why this is your best case?
I wouldn't necessarily characterize it my best case. I would characterize it as my defining case. This was my baptism by fire. It is what made it known to me what my job was going to be like in the DEA. And it honestly motivated me. It drove me to seek this type of work my entire career.
Well, that's amazing. That's really amazing.
Thank you.
It is. Carson, I can't tell you how much we appreciate you coming onto the podcast for this incredibly nerve-wracking two-part tale of your mission in Operation Snowcap in the Bolivian jungles. Thank you so much.
It was my pleasure. It was nice to meet you, and it's good to talk to you as well, Jim.
All right, great. Well, Carson, we'll have you back again to talk about a worst case, and hopefully you're living a much more relaxed and safe existence now that you retired from the DEA?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
All right, great. Well, thank you again for your service and for your great interviews that we did, and we hope to hear from you again shortly. Take care.
It's my pleasure. Take care, guys.
All right, and to our listeners, thank you for listening to Best Case, Worst Case. Until next time, signing off.
Best Case, Worst Case is an XG production. Produced by Jim Clementi at Empire Studios, LA. Engineered and edited by Mike Thal. Music composed and performed by Simba Tsumba. And hosted by Wonder.
You can listen to Best Case, Worst Case on your favorite listening app. We are on Spotify, Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, and wherever you listen to podcasts.
If you want to do something about child sexual abuse, Darkness Delight can help. Did you know that more than 90% of the time children are sexually abused by someone they know?
Jim, this isn't about stranger danger. It's about learning the true risks. Darkness to Light's training can help prevent, recognize, and react to child sexual abuse in your community.
When you make the decision to get involved, kids can be protected. It starts with you.
Visit www.d2l.org to take the training and learn more.
That's d2l.org.
Let's jump into Peppa's world of play. Look for spring flowers, hunt for muddy puddles, and bravely explore exciting places with Peppa play sets. Peppa Pig, inspiring kid confidence.